Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Randy Hawkins. He is the Chief Medical Officer for Carrum Health. Randy, thanks for joining me today.
Nick, a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me as your guest.
So, if you would, tell us a little bit about your background. You're a physician, you're working in the vendor community, you've had an interesting career. I think it lends an awful lot of credibility and relevance to the upcoming discussion. So share a little bit of that background and some of the high points, if you would.
Certainly. My name is Randy Hawkins. I am an anesthesiologist and critical care medicine physician. I practice as a medical officer in the United States Navy for many, many years, and also in private practice in New York and in New Hampshire, where I live now. I have been involved in the vendor community and industry as a chief medical officer for five companies now over a long period of time. My background is pretty straightforward, but it's progressed in a number of different ways. I started in electronic health records, are a high-tech and meaningful use timeframe, as you're very familiar with, but then moved into things like the algorithmic approach to chronic disease state management, FDA regulations, 510K submissions, bringing interesting products and services to market to help chronic conditions be managed more appropriately. Then I got into predictive analytic modeling and workflow science. How could we use data to effectively target folks, subpopulations with specific problems early in their journeys to affect the greatest amount of care and improvement? Then I got into the health navigation space with patient advocacy, treatment decision support, surgical decision support, expert medical opinion, second opinion services, things of that nature, to really focus on getting folks off the sidelines, getting them comfortable in participating with their healthcare journey. And now I find myself at Carrum Health as Chief Medical Officer, where we deal with a technology-enabled and analytically optimized platform where we bring centers of excellence providers onto the platform and the individual surgeons therein and arrange for care in a true prospective bundle payment arrangement. So we're bringing the highest quality care to large employer groups and their employees at dramatically reduced cost. So it's a pleasure to be here. That's a little bit about me, and I'd be very interested in engaging in any conversation points that you'd like to discuss.
Well, so before we get into that, I missed the Navy piece. And since my brother was in the Navy as a physician, I've got to ask you if the American Navy does the same as the British Navy and had you cutting hair on board ship.
I wasn't privileged to cut the hair. I'm sure they would have let me do it, Nick, to be honest with you, because we were all men and women of lots of hats. But it was an interesting time. It was way back in the original Arabian Gulf Wars, Desert Shield and Desert Storm, back in the late 80s and 90s. Served in the Middle East for a very long time and then came back to the United States.
Well, I'm always fascinated by that. And he actually ended up doing hair for the family when he came back. He learned the skill because that was one of his tasks on board, the ship's barber. So thank you for your service. Delighted to hear some of that and the journey. So tell us a little bit about the background to this sort of bundling. And I think one of the areas that, you know, for both of us are relevant in this is, what is the appropriate use of our limited healthcare resources? So we have this fantastic system, albeit it's not serving everybody appropriately. And, you know, some of that's associated with cost, but there's an awful lot of this. And, you know, it's a recurring theme in my show. We're not delivering the right care to the right patient at the right time.
Absolutely, Nick. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I do believe it is a fundamental aspect of our healthcare system that needs to be addressed. And I don't pretend to have all of the answers, but I do think about it as you do. We've discussed previously that this surgical appropriateness or appropriateness of care, or some folks are even calling it surgical avoidance, is a set of terminology that I believe mean the same thing. What we're asking, to your point initially, is surgery, for example, in our surgical subspecialties, the next best intervention for a patient at a given point in their journey, or said another way, are there lesser invasive, equally effective, less costly alternatives that they may consider? And if so, have those things been recommended? Those are the things that I think about in terms of avoiding surgery. I use a focal point in my analysis of appropriateness in the following manner. I consider there to be two principles in surgery. There's, of course, the patient and then the surgeon. And each, I believe, plays a significant role in determining what's appropriate at a given time. On the front end with the patient, it is in the realm of, as we see, surgical decision support vendors and expert medical opinion, second opinion services. These things which help activate the consumer, the new healthcare consumer, to say, hang on a second, give me access to some information and a handful of tools and help me build an experience set so I know how to consume healthcare goods and services the way I do other goods and services in my life. And that's one important thing, I think, in terms of avoiding surgery. When we become educated on what's right or available to us, we can raise our hand sometime and say, you know what? I don't think surgery is right for me at this time. The other component is the surgeon, that other principle in a surgery. And that's where folks like Carrum Health, who really focus on the highest quality individual practitioners, surgeons in our communities, and are gravitating towards those who do the right thing the highest percentage of time for individual patients. So they have a full understanding and appreciation for Randy Hawkins, for example, if I have back pain. Well, Randy, have you thought about lumbar epidural steroid injections, healthy weight loss, behavioral changes in exercise, physical therapy as less invasive approaches than me doing a microdiscectomy, laminectomy, infusion on your back? Our physicians on our platform, Nick, are skewed very heavily into that higher quality realm where appropriate surgical practice is the norm. So I think those are ways for us to, and large employer groups, to focus on appropriate care. The other key point, and then I'll stop, is appropriateness is so important in our way of thinking, Nick, that we focus on it first. And here's what I mean by that. We think of a triad. We think of doing appropriate surgery, and when surgery is necessary, doing the highest quality surgery. And then at the next and final step, we believe that that surgery should be done at a reasonable lower cost than in most cases we see today. If you solve for those three elements of the triad in an order that isn't specific, I think you run into two specific problems. If you solve for quality first, you're doing very, very high quality work that may or may not need to be done. We didn't determine if it was appropriate to do, yet we're doing high quality work on stuff that potentially didn't need to be done. The other problem I see us getting into is, all right, what if we solve the cost component first? And we say, okay, I'm going to lower cost. Then I'm saving you, the large employer group and the employee, money on something that didn't need to be done in the first place. So that's why we think it's important to do those things in a stepwise fashion.
You know, it's interesting you bring up those examples of, you know, the appropriateness of care. And it reminds me going back in time to cancer care and the standing sort of perspective, and I don't believe this is still true, was if you had cancer and you went to see the oncologist, he would poison you. If you went to see the radiation oncologist, he would irradiate you. And if you saw the surgical oncologist, he would cut it out. And we've approached this with a team-based approach, but I think it still suffers from the same kind of challenges that you describe of appropriateness. And you mentioned something in there that I think is critical and is a challenge, is where does the consumer play into this? Because they're not equipped necessarily to be able to, I don't want to say, they still make the decisions, but do they have the right information to be able to make those choices?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I don't believe we're all the way there, Nick. I don't believe, and often, you know, sometimes an overused term of the multidisciplinary approach. Cancer is a great example, Nick. When we talk about the triad of surgery, adjuvant radiation and chemotherapy, and if you talk to the individual providers in their subspecialties, you're right. You get, for lack of a better term, disparate information, right? You get pieces of the puzzle and not the full complement of what the full healthcare journey and picture looks like. In answer to your question, I think it is really important that these conversations become unified, where all the participants in all the facets of care are having an informed conversation with individual patients, kind of in real time, so that they don't get pieces of the puzzle. They get an idea as to what all the components are and how they fit together. I think the temporal relationship of information sharing is underappreciated. I don't think we give enough credit to the notion of when we provide the full picture to our patients. I think it's important to do it collectively as opposed to in individual pieces.
Yeah, as I think about that, let me posit an individual in all of this that has struggled over the course of time. That's the general practitioner or the family healthcare who sits at the nexus, but you know, in many instances, particularly in our system of fee-for-service, gets bypassed a lot of the time. People demand the right of, you know, immediate access. Is there perhaps an opportunity for a renaissance for those individuals? Because they're reasonably well equipped. They've been through the same training. They're not so specialized so they can pull that together. Could they be the healthcare navigator that would help support that individual, do you think?
I'm the first to admit when I hear a good idea, and I'm the first to give credit to those who present that idea. I hadn't heard that before, Nick. I like it very, very much. I think that the notion of a highly trained person that in medicine that is cognizant of all of these different pieces is the perfect quarterback, if you will, or chaperone of that healthcare journey and bringing those pieces together. I hadn't thought of primary care specialists and physicians and practitioners as serving in that role, but I love that idea. It makes an awful lot of sense.
Interesting. So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Randy Hawkins. He's the chief medical officer for Carrum Health. We were just talking about appropriateness of care and, you know, the triad, as you rightly describe, of all of those contributing. So, you know, great. So you fixed the quality and you got the best quality, but delivering it to the wrong people and importantly, at the wrong price as well. So,
right,
important through all of that. As you think about this newfound approach, so when I think we're moving off the fee for service, I mean, we're still at 30% or so, as I understand. We're getting more to value-based coverage. I think we're seeing more in the way of employers taking responsibility and not just passing that on to an agent, let's call it. How do you start to deploy all of this in a way that they can make the best decisions? I mean, I think we've seen some good examples. Walmart, I believe it was Walmart, and I don't know that this is the best example, but they sent patients to another state, even across borders, I think, for care and whatever. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the right approach, but, you know, that was addressing a piece of the problem. How do we bring this all together so that it affects everybody all the way down to the 10, 50 person employers so that they get all of that great care?
Great question, Nick. And we've been wrestling with this for a while, right? The Walmart example is just that. It was that initial foray into the center of excellence strategy where coverage or penetration of markets was minimal. The quality was there, but access was a real challenge. It was very difficult to, without extensive travel, you're right, across state borders, definitely, but across international borders in some cases. I think the reality is we need to consider all of those components. Highest quality, appropriate care, and deliver on that network component, deliver on that access challenge. Here's what I say in my organization and in the market when I have the privilege of speaking with others. I can't create high quality that doesn't exist, but it is my job as the chief medical officer of Carrum Health to find that highest quality everywhere that it exists. So what I'm trying to solve for is really, I think, the answer to your question. We need to tease out, we need to extract that highest quality, most appropriate care on every corner that we can find it and not settle for, and here's the true answer, not settle for pins on a map. I don't want to pretend that Everywhere you look outside your window is a highest quality provider because that will solve the access challenge. I really think just like cost and quality, it's an access and quality balance that we need to strike. I want to find it everywhere it is, and I want to provide it more comprehensively than those initial models that just said, yep, there are two places in the world where you go to have your knee fixed. I'm going to send you to one of those two.
I like that. And I like the sort of no more pins on the map. I think that's a good visual that sort of helps amplify that point. So we've all been experiencing the pandemic. It's represented a just a range of problems. But one of those has been the inadequacies of the delivery of care. There was a cohort of patients that I think is going to trouble the system for some considerable period of time, that has missed out on interventions that were hopefully appropriate through that triad that you described. How do we go about addressing that? Is there a pathway to help this group? Because they seem particularly impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's correct, right? We talk about a backlog of elective surgeries or a pent-up demand to have certain procedures done. I think that's all true. If we look back at 2020, it was certainly true, right? Because we kind of locked it down. We needed to preserve resources and increase capacity in our existing healthcare system. And we did that by postponing and delaying elective surgical procedures, knees, hips, backs, certain forms of hysterectomies, bariatric surgery, to be sure, and others. And I think you're right. That pent-up demand did three things happened. And I think some are obvious, but I think all of them are undeniable. The first and the most obvious is, yep, the number of delayed surgeries went up. The volume of cases to be done, at least in general terms, has increased dramatically. We have an issue. The second thing is a little less obvious, but I think just as important is the whole notion of, because of this delay, there has been a concomitant delay in maintenance of health and chronic condition management. My point being that the subpopulation of those folks who were teed up for elective surgeries did not get healthier over the course of the pandemic. They still have their comorbidities, their conditions, and they didn't necessarily improve upon the state of those conditions. Diabetes didn't get better. Hypertension was sometimes unchecked because folks were unwilling or unable to engage in the healthcare system to manage those conditions. So I think, and as we think of all of these things in a go-forward fashion, those same patients who are less well-prepared to have their elective surgery are going to cost us more because of all of these comorbidities that are potentially out of whack. And the third thing is just a truism. As a function of the fee-for-service model that still, to your point, remains in place somewhat to this day, we had a challenge to the revenue streams of, you know, acute care providers and their surgeons therein. And just as a matter of fact, the downturn in revenue of 2020 and the intermittent revenue of 2021, they're going to look to actively recoup. And we see this in the market. We see folks advertising availability for your surgical procedure that was delayed because of the pandemic. In and of itself, not necessarily a bad thing, but it does bring us back to our first topic of discussion, Nick, which is appropriateness of care. Does the landscape changing and opening up access to elective procedures make surgeons more likely to operate than not, all things being considered? We have to take the confluence of these three forces, pent-up demand and volume, the comorbidities not being as well prepared, and this notion of, I need to recoup revenue, all coming together and making large employers and their employees suffer from higher availability and likelihood of maybe less appropriate surgical intervention and the cost overrun associated with that, you know, post-obstructive diuresis, if you will, of patients coming to the operating room looking for their procedure to be done.
I love that. Post-obstructive diuresis for it. That's a perfect term. That's just great. So as you think about it, one of my sort of focus areas is very much around price. I come from a different system. where price was not the sort of focal point. I've struggled with it ever since I've been in this country. It continues to be a problem. The one thing that I've seen that I think is helping change the way that we think about these things is the transparency, which we didn't have. It's been fought tooth and nail by all sorts of vested interests. Is that going to start to contribute and help bring things down?
Absolutely. Right. I believe, like I was saying about appropriateness of care being the first step, I believe price transparency is the first necessary step to helping bring down costs. You can't fully appreciate and understand how much more you're paying for a service or a good than somebody else until you know what that is. So I am with you 100% on that, Nick. We have to completely instill this notion of price transparency into the cost reduction strategies that we're looking to employ. The other component, I think we might agree on this as well, is the notion of prospective bundling of pricing, making which is in and of itself, right? By definition, transparent. I know before I do it what the price of that service is going to be. That makes me feel better about what I'm going to pay. But it also aligns incentives, Nick. What I love about the bundle payment approach is it does things for the surgeon. It does things for the employer. It does things for the patient. For the surgeon, it gets them paid right away. They know what they're going to get paid, and they don't have to struggle to get it with individual bills from anesthesiologists and so on and so forth. The thing that it does for the employer is it makes it predictable to budget for their medical spend. If I know what I'm going to pay, the incident rate of the surgeries involved, I can calculate what it's going to cost me, and I'll know, and here's a real key point for everybody, that the incentives for the surgeon are going to be aligned with my incentives. The surgeons are going to be very selective in who they choose for a procedure because they know they're on the hook. There are going to be warranties in place. I have to cover the complications and readmissions for a 30, 60, 90-day period in association with my care. That's part of the deal. That's part of the bundle. I have to sign up for that. So I'm going to select my patients carefully. And I'm also going to be given compensation for doing the right thing. So there has to be in place a consultation fee or a stipend so that if I look at you, Nick, and I say, I understand that your hip hurts, but looking at the amount of disease in the joint and your age and things like, I think there are other things we can do. If the surgeons are compensated for their time and their effort for doing the right thing, again, incentives are aligned. So I think bundling pricing, aligning incentives, giving warranties, and being transparent will get that last step in my triad, Nick, lowering cost, to become more of a reality than it is today.
Yeah, I think that represents a truly positive trajectory, especially as we move away from this fee-for-service that, you get what you incent. It's inevitable. And I never start out with the premise that people are doing things because they want to be, everybody gets up in the morning wanting to do the right thing, deliver the best possible care, the best possible choices. But ultimately, you are influenced by the system that surrounds you. It's impossible to sort of escape that. And we have to align the incentives. And I think bundling of payments and the certainty that that allows people to be able to plan both on the delivery side, but also for the patient side, it sort of removes that need for no more surprise billing. As you think about this over the course of the future, what are you excited about?
I'm most excited, Nick, to be honest with you, at the conversation. I'm very fortunate, I think you are as well, through this platform, to have these intelligent and informed conversations from a number of different viewpoints. I'm encouraged by that. People, benefit leaders from around the country are asking the right questions. They're aligning priorities with the pain points they see and then the employees that they serve. I love that. I'll put it this way. I learn more from benefit leaders than I do from potentially anybody else in the market because they've got this platform, this benefits platform, or this administration platform, and they're serving populations that are diverse. And they've got input at all times about what's being provided and how well it's meeting the needs of the population. So I'm encouraged by The conversations that are going on nationwide, and I think if we continue the conversation, we're going to make progress in a very efficient manner.
Fantastic. Unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time, so it just remains for me to thank you for joining me on the show. Randy, thanks for coming on the show.
Nick, thank you very much for having me. It has been an absolute pleasure, and I'd be happy to join you at any time. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.